Silent Spring, Disc 4.
Chapter 8, And No Birds Sing. Over increasingly large areas of the United States, spring now comes unheralded by the return of the birds, and the early mornings are strangely silent where once they were filled with the beauty of birdsong. This sudden silencing of the song of birds, this obliteration of the color and beauty and interest they lend to our world, have come about swiftly, insidiously, and unnoticed by those whose communities are as yet unaffected. From the town of Hinsdale, Illinois, a housewife wrote in despair to one of the world's leading ornithologists, Robert Cushman Murphy, curator emeritus of birds at the American Museum of Natural History. "Here in our village, the elm trees have been sprayed for several years," she wrote in 1958. "When we moved here 6 years ago, there was a wealth of bird life. I put up a feeder and had a steady stream of cardinals, chickadees, downies, and nuthatches all winter, and the cardinals and chickadees brought their young ones in the summer. After several years of DDT spray, the town is almost devoid of robins and starlings. Chickadees have not been on my shelf for 2 years, and this year the cardinals are gone too. The nesting population in the neighborhood seems to consist of one dove pair and perhaps one catbird family. It is hard to explain to the children that the birds have been killed off when they have learned in school that a federal law protects the birds from killing or capture. Will they ever come back, they ask? And I do not have the answer. The elms are still dying, and so are the birds. Is anything being done? Can anything be done? Can I do anything?" A year after the federal government had launched a massive spraying program against the fire ant, an Alabama woman wrote, "Our place has been a veritable bird sanctuary for over half a century. Last July, we all remarked there are more birds than ever. Then suddenly, in the second week of August, they all disappeared. I was accustomed to rising early to care for my favorite mare that had a young filly. There was not a sound of the song of a bird. It was eerie, terrifying. What was man doing to our perfect and beautiful world? Finally, 5 months later, a blue jay appeared and a wren." The autumn months to which she referred brought other somber reports from the deep south, where in Mississippi, Louisiana, and Alabama, the field notes, published quarterly by the National Audubon Society and the United States Fish and Wildlife Service, noted the striking phenomenon of blank spots, weirdly empty of virtually all bird life. The field notes are a compilation of the reports of seasoned observers who have spent many years afield in their particular areas and of unparalleled knowledge of the normal bird life of the region. One such observer reported that in driving about southern Mississippi that fall, she saw no land birds at all for long distances. Another in Baton Rouge reported that the contents of her feeders had lain untouched for weeks on end, while fruiting shrubs in her yard that ordinarily would be stripped clean by that time still were laden with berries. Still another reported that his picture window, which often used to frame a scene splashed with the red of 40 or 50 cardinals and crowded with other species, seldom permitted a view of as many as a bird or two at a time. Professor Maurice Brooks of the University of West Virginia, an authority on the birds of the Appalachian region, reported that the West Virginia bird population had undergone an incredible reduction. One story might serve as the tragic symbol of the fate of the birds, a fate that has already overtaken some species and that threatens all. It is the story of the robin, the bird known to everyone. To millions of Americans, the season's first robin means that the grip of winter is broken. Its coming is an event reported in newspapers and told eagerly at the breakfast table. And as the number of migrants grows and the first mists of green appear in the woodlands, thousands of people listen for the first dawn chorus of the robins throbbing in the early morning light. But now all has changed, and not even the return of the birds may be taken for granted. The survival of the robin, and indeed of many other species as well, seems fatefully linked with the American elm, a tree that is part of the history of thousands of towns from the Atlantic to the Rockies, gracing their streets and their village squares and college campuses with majestic archways of green. Now the elms are stricken with a disease that afflicts them throughout their range, a disease so serious that many experts believe all efforts to save the elms will in the end be futile. It would be tragic to lose the elms, but it would be doubly tragic if in vain efforts to save them we plunge vast segments of our bird populations into the night of extinction. Yet this is precisely what is threatened. The so-called Dutch elm disease entered the United States from Europe about 1930 in elm burl logs imported for the veneer industry. It is a fungus disease. The organism invades the water-conducting vessels of the tree, spreads by spores carried in the flow of sap, and by its poisonous secretions, as well as by mechanical clogging, causes the branches to wilt and the tree to die. The disease is spread from diseased to healthy trees by elm bark beetles. The galleries which the insects have tunneled out under the bark of dead trees become contaminated with spores of the invading fungus, and the spores adhere to the insect body and are carried wherever the beetle flies. Efforts to control the fungus disease of the elms have been directed largely toward control of the carrier insect. In community after community, especially throughout the strongholds of the American elm, the Midwest and New England, intensive spraying has become a routine procedure. What this spraying could mean to bird life, and especially to the robin, was first made clear by the work of two ornithologists at Michigan State University, Professor George Wallace and one of his graduate students, John Maynor. When Mr. Maynor began work for the doctorate in 1954, he chose a research project that had to do with robin populations. This was quite by chance, for at that time no one suspected that the robins were in danger. But even as he undertook the work, events occurred that were to change its character and indeed to deprive him of his material. Spraying for Dutch elm disease began in a small way on the university campus in 1954. The following year, the city of East Lansing, where the university is located, joined in. Spraying on the campus was expanded, and with local programs for gypsy moth and mosquito control also underway, the rain of chemicals increased to a downpour. During 1954, the year of the first light spraying, all seemed well. The following spring, the migrating robins began to return to the campus as usual. Like the bluebells in Tomlinson's haunting essay, The Lost Wood, they were expecting no evil as they reoccupied their familiar territories. But soon it became evident that something was wrong. Dead and dying robins began to appear on the campus. Few birds were seen in their normal foraging activities or assembling in their usual roosts. Few nests were built. Few young appeared. The pattern was repeated with monotonous regularity in succeeding springs. The sprayed area had become a lethal trap in which each wave of migrating robins would be eliminated in about a week. Then new arrivals would come in, only to add to the numbers of doomed birds seen on the campus in the agonized tremors that precede death. The campus is serving as a graveyard for most of the robins that attempt to take up residence in the spring, said Dr. Wallace. But why? At first he suspected some disease of the nervous system, but soon it became evident that in spite of the assurances of the insecticide people that their sprays were harmless to birds, the robins were really dying of insecticidal poisoning. They exhibited the well-known symptoms of loss of balance, followed by tremors, convulsions, and death. Several facts suggested that the robins were being poisoned not so much by direct contact with the insecticides as indirectly by eating earthworms. Campus earthworms had been fed inadvertently to crayfish in a research project, and all the crayfish had promptly died. A snake kept in a laboratory cage had gone into violent tremors after being fed such worms. And earthworms are the principal food of robins in the spring. A key piece in the jigsaw puzzle of the doomed robins was soon to be supplied by Dr. Roy Barker of the Illinois Natural History Survey at Urbana. Dr. Barker's work, published in 1958, traced the intricate cycle of events by which the robin's fate is linked to the elm trees by way of the earthworms. The trees are sprayed in the spring, usually at the rate of 2 to 5 pounds of DDT per 50-foot tree, which may be the equivalent of as much as 23 pounds per acre where elms are numerous, and often again in July at about half this concentration. Powerful sprayers direct a stream of poison to all parts of the tallest trees, killing directly not only the target organism, the bark beetle, but other insects, including pollinating species and predatory spiders and beetles. The poison forms a tenacious film over the leaves and bark. Rains do not wash it away. In the autumn, the leaves fall to the ground, accumulate in sodden layers, and begin the slow process of becoming one with the soil. In this, they are aided by the toil of the earthworms, who feed in the leaf litter, for elm leaves are among their favorite foods. In feeding on the leaves, the worms also swallow the insecticide, accumulating and concentrating it in their bodies. Dr. Barker found deposits of DDT throughout the digestive tracts of the worms, their blood vessels, nerves, and body wall. Undoubtedly, some of the earthworms themselves succumb, but others survive to become biological magnifiers of the poison. In the spring, the robins return to provide another link in the cycle. As few as 11 large earthworms can transfer a lethal dose of DDT to a robin, and 11 worms form a small part of a day's rations to a bird that eats 10 to 12 earthworms in as many minutes. Not all robins receive a lethal dose, but another consequence may lead to the extinction of their kind as surely as fatal poisoning. The shadow of sterility lies over all the bird studies and indeed lengthens to include all living things within its potential range. There are now only 2 or 3 dozen robins to be found each spring on the entire 185-acre campus of Michigan State University, compared with a conservatively estimated 370 adults in this area before spring. In 1954, every robin nest under observation by Mayner produced young. Toward the end of June 1957, when at least 370 young birds, the normal replacement of the adult population, would have been foraging over the campus in the years before the spraying began, Mayner could find only one young robin. A year later, Dr. Wallace was to report, "At no time during the spring or summer of 1958 did I see a fledgling robin anywhere on the main campus, and so far I have failed to find anyone else who had seen one there." Part of this failure to produce young is due, of course, to the fact that one or more of a pair of robins dies before the nesting cycle is completed. But Wallace has significant records which point to something more sinister: the actual destruction of the bird's capacity to reproduce. He has, for example, records of robins and other birds building nests but laying no eggs, and others laying eggs and incubating them but not hatching them. We have one record of a robin who sat on its eggs faithfully for 21 days and they did not hatch. The normal incubation period is 13 days. Our analyses are showing high concentrations of DDT in the testes and ovaries of breeding birds, he told a congressional committee in 1960. 10 males had amounts ranging from 30 to 109 parts per million in the testes, and 2 females had 151 and 211 parts per million, respectively, in the egg follicles in their ovaries. Soon studies in other areas began to develop findings equally dismal. Professor Joseph Hickey and his students at the University of Wisconsin, after careful comparative studies of sprayed and unsprayed areas, reported the robin mortality to be at least 86% to 88%. The Cranbrook Institute of Science at Bloomfield Hills, Michigan, in an effort to assess the extent of bird loss caused by the spraying of the elms, asked in 1956 that all birds thought to be victims of DDT poisoning be turned in to the Institute for examination. The request had a response beyond all expectations. Within a few weeks, the deep freeze facilities of the Institute were taxed to capacity so that other specimens had to be refused. By 1959, 1,000 poisoned birds from this single community had been turned in or reported. Although the robin was the chief victim, one woman calling the Institute reported 12 robins lying dead on her lawn as she spoke. 63 different species were included among the specimens examined at the Institute. The robins, then, are only one part of the chain of devastation linked to the spraying of the elms, even as the elm program is only one of the multitudinous spray programs that cover our land with poisons. Heavy mortality has occurred among about 90 species of birds, including those most familiar to suburbanites and amateur naturalists. The populations of nesting birds in general have declined as much as 90% in some of the sprayed towns. As we shall see, all the various types of birds are affected: ground feeders, treetop feeders, bark feeders, predators. It is only reasonable to suppose that all birds and mammals heavily dependent on earthworms or other soil organisms for food are threatened by the robin's fate. Some 45 species of birds include earthworms in their diet. Among them is the woodcock, a species that winters in southern areas recently heavily sprayed with heptachlor. Two significant discoveries have now been made about the woodcock. Production of young birds on the New Brunswick breeding grounds is definitely reduced, and adult birds that have been analyzed contain large residues of DDT and heptachlor. Already, there are disturbing records of heavy mortality among more than 20 other species of ground-feeding birds whose food, worms, ants, grubs, or other soil organisms, has been poisoned. These include three of the thrushes, whose songs are among the most exquisite of bird voices, the olive-backed, the wood, and the hermit. And the sparrows that flit through the shrubby understory of the woodlands and forage with rustling sounds amid the fallen leaves, the song sparrow and the white throat. These too have been found among the victims of the elm sprays. Mammals also may easily be involved in the cycle, directly or indirectly. Earthworms are important among the various foods of the raccoon and are eaten in the spring and fall by opossums. Such subterranean tunnelers as shrews and moles capture them in some numbers and then perhaps pass on the poison to predators such as screech owls and barn owls. Several dying screech owls were picked up in Wisconsin following heavy rains in spring, perhaps poisoned by feeding on earthworms. Hawks and owls have been found in convulsions. Great horned owls, screech owls, red-shouldered hawks, sparrow hawks, marsh hawks. These may be cases of secondary poisoning caused by eating birds or mice that have accumulated insecticides in their livers or other organs. Nor is it only the creatures that forage on the ground or those who prey on them that are endangered by the foliar spraying of the elms. All of the treetop feeders, the birds that glean their insect food from the leaves, have disappeared from heavily sprayed areas. Among them, those woodland sprites, the kinglets, both ruby-crowned and golden-crowned, the tiny gnatcatchers, and many of the warblers, whose migrating hordes flow through the trees in spring in a multicolored tide of life. In 1956, a late spring delayed spraying so that it coincided with the arrival of an exceptionally heavy wave of warbler migration. Nearly all species of warblers present in the area were represented in the heavy kill that followed. In Whitefish Bay, Wisconsin, at least 1,000 myrtle warblers could be seen in migration during former years. In 1958, after the spraying of the elms, observers could find only two. So with additions from other communities, the list grows, and the warblers killed by the spray include those that most charm and fascinate all who are aware of them: the black and white, the yellow, the magnolia, and the Cape May. The ovenbird, whose call throbs in the Maytime woods, the Blackburnian, whose wings are touched with flame, the chestnut-sided, the Canadian, and the black-throated green, these treetop feeders are affected either directly by eating poisoned insects or indirectly by a shortage of food. The loss of food has also struck hard at the swallows that cruise the skies, straining out the aerial insects as herrings strain the plankton of the sea. A Wisconsin naturalist reported, "Swallows have been hard hit. Everyone complains of how few they have compared to 4 or 5 years ago. Our sky overhead was full of them only 4 years ago. Now we seldom see any. This could be both lack of insects because of spray or poisoned insects." Of other birds, this same observer wrote, "Another striking loss is the phoebe. Flycatchers are scarce everywhere, but the early, hardy, common phoebe is no more. I've seen one this spring, and only one last spring." Other birders in Wisconsin make the same complaint. "I have had 5 or 6 pairs of cardinals in the past. None now. Wrens, robins, catbirds, and screech owls have nested each year in our garden. There are none now. Summer mornings are without bird song. Only pest birds, pigeons, starlings, and English sparrows remain. It is tragic, and I can't bear it." The dormant sprays applied to the elms in the fall, sending the poison into every little crevice in the bark, are probably responsible for the severe reduction observed in the numbers of chickadees, nuthatches, titmice, woodpeckers, and brown creepers. During the winter of 1957-58, Dr. Wallace saw no chickadees or nuthatches at his home feeding station for the first time in many years. 3 nuthatches he found later provided a sorry little step-by-step lesson in cause and effect. One was feeding on an elm, another was found dying of typical DDT symptoms, the third was dead. The dying nuthatch was later found to have 226 parts per million of DDT in its tissues. The feeding habits of all these birds not only make them especially vulnerable to insect sprays, but also make their loss a deplorable one for economic as well as less tangible reasons. The summer food of the white-breasted nuthatch and the brown creeper, for example, include the eggs, larvae, and adults of a very large number of insects injurious to trees. About 3/4 of the food of the chickadee is animal, including all stages of the life cycle of many insects. The chickadee's method of feeding is described in Bent's monumental Life Histories of North American Birds. As the flock moves along, each bird examines minutely bark, twigs, and branches, searching for tiny bits of food, spiders' eggs, cocoons, or other dormant insect life. Various scientific studies have established the critical role of birds in insect control in various situations. Thus, woodpeckers are the primary control of the Engelmann spruce beetle, reducing its population from 45% to 98%, and are important in the control of the codling moth in apple orchards. Chickadees and other winter resident birds can protect orchards against the cankerworm. But what happens in nature is not allowed to happen in the modern chemical-drenched world, where spraying destroys not only the insects, but their principal enemy, the birds. When later there is a resurgence of the insect population, as almost always happens, the birds are not there to keep their numbers in check. As the curator of birds at the Milwaukee Public Museum, Owen J. Grom wrote to the Milwaukee Journal, "The greatest enemy of insect life is other predatory insects, birds, and some small mammals. But DDT kills indiscriminately, including nature's own safeguards or policemen. In the name of progress, are we to become victims of our own diabolical means of insect control to provide temporary comfort only to lose out to destroying insects later on? By what means will we control new pests which will attack remaining tree species after the elms are gone, when nature's safeguards, the birds, have been wiped out by poison?" Mr. Grom reported that calls and letters about dead and dying birds have been increasing steadily during the years since spraying began in Wisconsin. Questioning always revealed that spraying or fogging had been done in the area where the birds were dying. Mr. Grom's experience has been shared by ornithologists and conservationists at most of the research centers of the Midwest, such as the Cranbrook Institute in Michigan, the Illinois Natural History Survey, and the University of Wisconsin. A glance at the letters from readers' column of newspapers, almost anywhere that spraying is being done, makes clear the fact that citizens are not only becoming aroused and indignant, but that often they show a keener understanding of the dangers and inconsistencies of spraying than do the officials who order it done. I am dreading the days to come soon now when many beautiful birds will be dying in our backyard, wrote a Milwaukee woman. This is a pitiful, heartbreaking experience. It is, moreover, frustrating and exasperating, for it evidently does not serve the purpose the slaughter was intended to serve. Taking a long look, can you save trees without also saving birds? Do they not, in the economy of nature, save each other? Isn't it possible to help the balance of nature without destroying it? The idea that the elms, majestic shade trees though they are not sacred cows and do not justify an open-end campaign of destruction against all other forms of life is expressed in other letters. I have always loved our elm trees, which seemed like trademarks on our landscape, wrote another Wisconsin woman. But there are many kinds of trees. We must save our birds, too. Can anyone imagine anything so cheerless and dreary as a springtime without a robin's song? To the public, the choice may easily appear to be one of stark black or white simplicity. Shall we have birds or shall we have elms? But it is not as simple as that. And by one of the ironies that abound throughout the field of chemical control, we may very well end by having neither if we continue on our present well-traveled road. Spraying is killing the birds, but it is not saving the elms. The illusion that salvation of the elms lies at the end of a spray nozzle is a dangerous will-o'-the-wisp that is leading one community after another into a morass of heavy expenditures without producing lasting results. Greenwich, Connecticut sprayed regularly for 10 years. Then a drought year brought conditions especially favorable to the beetle, and the mortality of elms went up 1,000%. In Urbana, Illinois, where the University of Illinois is located, Dutch elm disease first appeared in 1951. Spraying was undertaken in 1953. By 1959, in spite of 6 years spraying, the university campus had lost 86% of its elms, half of them victims of Dutch elm disease. In Toledo, Ohio, a similar experience caused the superintendent of forestry, Joseph A. Sweeney, to take a realistic look at the results of spraying. Spraying was begun there in 1953 and continued through 1959. Meanwhile, however, Mr. Sweeney had noticed that a citywide infestation of the cottony maple scale was worse after the spraying recommended by the books and the authorities than it had been before. He decided to review the results of spraying for Dutch elm disease for himself. His findings shocked him. In the city of Toledo, he found the only areas under any control were the areas where we used some promptness in removing the diseased or brood trees. Where we depended on spraying, the disease was out of control. In the country where nothing has been done, the disease has not spread as fast as it has in the city. This indicates that spraying destroys any natural enemies. We are abandoning spraying for the Dutch elm disease. This has brought me into conflict with the people who back any recommendations by the United States Department of Agriculture, but I have the facts and will stick with them. It is difficult to understand why these Midwestern towns to which the elm disease spread only rather recently have so unquestioningly embarked on ambitious and expensive spraying programs, apparently without waiting to inquire into the experience of other areas that have had longer acquaintance with the problem. New York State, for example, has certainly had the longest history of continuous experience with Dutch elm disease, for it was via the Port of New York that diseased elm wood is thought to have entered the United States about 1930. And New York State today has a most impressive record of containing and suppressing the disease. Yet it has not relied upon spraying. In fact, its Agricultural Extension Service does not recommend spraying as a community method of control. How, then, has New York achieved its fine record? From the early years of the battle for the elms to the present time, it has relied upon rigorous sanitation, or the prompt removal and destruction of all diseased or infected wood. In the beginning, some of the results were disappointing, but this was because it was not at first understood that not only diseased trees, but all elm wood in which the beetles might breed must be destroyed. Infected elm wood, after being cut and stored for firewood, will release a crop of fungus-carrying beetles unless burned before spring. It is the adult beetles emerging from hibernation to feed in late April and May that transmit Dutch elm disease. New York entomologists have learned by experience what kinds of beetle breeding material have real importance in the spread of the disease. By concentrating on this dangerous material, it has been possible not only to get good results, but to keep the cost of the sanitation program within reasonable limits. By 1950, the incidence of Dutch elm disease in New York City had been reduced to 0.2% of the city's 55,000 elms. A sanitation program was launched in Westchester County in 1942. During the next 14 years, the average annual loss of elms was only 0.2% a year. Buffalo, with 185,000 elms, has an excellent record of containing the disease by sanitation, with recent annual losses amounting to only 0.3%. In other words, at this rate of loss, it would take about 300 years to eliminate Buffalo's elms. What has happened in Syracuse is especially impressive. There, no effective program was in operation before 1957. Between 1951 and 1956, Syracuse lost nearly 3,000 elms. Then, under the direction of Howard C. Miller of the New York State University College of Forestry, an intensive drive was made to remove all diseased elm trees and all possible sources of beetle-breeding elm wood. The rate of loss is now well below 1% a year. The economy of the sanitation method is stressed by New York experts in Dutch elm disease control. In most cases, the actual expense is small compared with the probable saving, says J.G. Mathis of the New York State College of Agriculture. If it is a case of a dead or broken limb, the limb would have to be removed eventually as a precaution against possible property damage or personal injury. If it is a fuel wood pile, the wood can be used before spring. The bark can be peeled from the wood, or the wood can be stored in a dry place. In the case of dying or dead elm trees, the expense of prompt removal to prevent Dutch elm disease spread is usually no greater than would be necessary later, for most dead trees in urban regions must be removed eventually. The situation with regard to Dutch elm disease is therefore not entirely hopeless, provided informed and intelligent measures are taken. While it cannot be eradicated by any means now known once it has become established in a community, it can be suppressed and contained within reasonable bounds by sanitation, and without the use of methods that are not only futile, but involve tragic destruction of bird life. Other possibilities lie within the field of forest genetics, where experiments offer hope of developing a hybrid elm resistant to Dutch elm disease. The European elm is highly resistant, and many of them have been planted in Washington, D.C. Even during a period when a high percentage of the city's elms were affected, no cases of Dutch elm disease were found among these trees. Replanting through an immediate tree nursery and forestry program is being urged in communities that are losing large numbers of elms. This is important. And although such programs might well include the resistant European elms, they should aim at a variety of species so that no future epidemic could deprive a community of its trees. The key to a healthy plant or animal community lies in what the British ecologist Charles Elton calls the conservation of variety. What is happening now is in large part a result of the biological unsophistication of past generations. Even a generation ago, no one knew that to fill large areas with a single species of tree was to invite disaster. And so whole towns lined their streets and dotted their parks with elms. And today the elms die, and so do the birds. Like the robin, another American bird seems to be on the verge of extinction. This is the national symbol, the eagle. Its populations have dwindled alarmingly within the past decade. The facts suggest that something is at work in the eagle's environment which has virtually destroyed its ability to reproduce. What this may be is not yet definitely known, but there is some evidence that insecticides are responsible. The most intensively studied eagles in North America have been those nesting along a stretch of coast from Tampa to Fort Myers on the western coast of Florida. There, a retired banker from Winnipeg, Charles Broly, achieved ornithological fame by banding more than 1,000 young bald eagles during the years 1939 to 49. Only 166 eagles had been banded in all the earlier history of bird banding. Mr. Broly banded eagles as young birds during the winter months before they had left their nests. Later recoveries of banded birds showed that these Florida-born eagles range northward along the coast into Canada as far as Prince Edward Island, although they had previously been considered non-migratory. In the fall, they return to the south, their migration being observed at such famous vantage points as Hawk Mountain in eastern Pennsylvania. During the early years of his banding, Mr. Broly used to find 125 active nests a year on the stretch of coast he had chosen for his work. The number of young banded each year was about 150. In 1947, the production of young birds began to decline. Some nests contained no eggs. Others contained eggs that failed to hatch. Between 1952 and 1957, about 80% of the nests failed to produce young. In the last year of this period, only 43 nests were occupied. 7 of them produced young, 8 eaglets. 23 contained eggs that failed to hatch. 13 were used merely as feeding stations by adult eagles and contained no eggs. In 1958, Mr. Broly ranged over 100 miles of coast before finding and banding one eaglet. Adult eagles, which have been seen at 43 nests in 1957, were so scarce that he observed them at only 10 nests. Although Mr. Broly's death in 1959 terminated this valuable series of uninterrupted observations, reports by the Florida Audubon Society, as well as from New Jersey and Pennsylvania, confirm the trend that may well make it necessary for us to find a new national emblem. The reports of Maurice Broom, curator of the Hawk Mountain Sanctuary, are especially significant. Hawk Mountain is a picturesque mountaintop in southeastern Pennsylvania, where the easternmost ridges of the Appalachians form a last barrier to the westerly winds before dropping away toward the coastal plain. Winds striking the mountains are deflected upward so that on many autumn days there is a continuous updraft on which the broad-winged hawks and eagles ride without effort, covering many miles of their southward migration in a day. At Hawk Mountain, the ridges converge, and so do the aerial highways. The result is that from a widespread territory to the north, birds pass through this traffic bottleneck. In his more than a score of years as custodian of the sanctuary there, Maurice Broom has observed and actually tabulated more hawks and eagles than any other American. The peak of the bald eagle migration comes in late August and early September. These are assumed to be Florida birds returning to home territory after a summer in the north. Later in the fall and early winter, a few larger eagles drift through. These are thought to belong to a northern race bound for an unknown wintering ground. During the first years after the sanctuary was established, from 1935 to 1939, 40% of the eagles observed were yearlings, easily identified by their uniformly dark plumage. But in recent years, these immature birds have become a rarity. Between 1955 and 1959, they made up only 20% of the total count. And in 1 year, 1957, there was only one young eagle for every 32 adults. Observations at Hawk Mountain are in line with findings elsewhere. One such report comes from Elton Fox, an official of the Natural Resources Council of Illinois. Eagles, probably northern nesters, winter along the Mississippi and Illinois rivers. In 1958, Mr. Fox reported that a recent count of 59 eagles had included only one immature bird. Similar indications of the dying out of the race come from the world's only sanctuary for eagles alone, Mount Johnson Island in the Susquehanna River. The island, although only 8 miles above Conowingo Dam and about a half a mile out from the Lancaster County shore, retains its primitive wildness. Since 1934, its single eagle nest has been under observation by Professor Herbert H. Beck, an ornithologist of Lancaster and custodian of the sanctuary. Between 1935 and 1947, use of the nest was regular and uniformly successful. Since 1947, although the adults have occupied the nest and there is evidence of egg laying, no young eagles have been produced. On Mount Johnson Island, as well as in Florida, then, the same situation prevails. There is some occupancy of nests by adults, some production of eggs, but few or no young birds. In seeking an explanation, only one appears to fit all the facts. This is that the reproductive capacity of the birds has been so lowered by some environmental agent that there are now almost no annual additions of young to maintain the race. Exactly this sort of situation has been produced artificially in other birds by various experimenters, notably Dr. James DeWitt of the United States Fish and Wildlife Service. Dr. DeWitt's now classic experiments on the effect of a series of insecticides on quail and pheasants have established the fact that exposure to DDT or related chemicals, even when doing no observable harm to the parent birds, may seriously affect reproduction. The way the effect is exerted may vary, but the end result is always the same. For example, quail, into whose diet DDT was introduced throughout the breeding season, survived and even produced normal numbers of fertile eggs, but few of the eggs hatched. Many embryos appeared to develop normally during the early stages of incubation, but died during the hatching period, Dr. DeWitt said. Of those that did hatch, more than half died within 5 days. In other tests, in which both pheasants and quail were the subjects, the adults produced no eggs whatever if they had been fed insecticide-contaminated diets throughout the year. And at the University of California, Dr. Robert Rudd and Dr. Richard Ginelli reported similar findings. When pheasants received dieldrin in their diets, egg production was markedly lowered and chick survival was poor. According to these authors, the delayed but lethal effect on the young birds follows from storage of dieldrin in the yolk of the egg, from which it is gradually assimilated during incubation and after hatching. This suggestion is strongly supported by recent studies by Dr. Wallace and a graduate student, Richard F. Bernard, who found high concentrations of DDT in robins on the Michigan State University campus. They found the poison in all of the testes of male robins examined, in developing egg follicles, in the ovaries of females, in completed but unlaid eggs, in the oviducts, in unhatched eggs from deserted nests, in embryos within the eggs, and in a newly hatched dead nestling. These important studies establish the fact that the insecticidal poison affects a generation once removed from initial contact with it. Storage of poison in the egg, in the yolk material that nourishes the developing embryo, is a virtual death warrant and explains why so many of DeWitt's birds died in the egg or a few days after hatching. Laboratory application of these studies to eagles presents difficulties that are nearly insuperable. but field studies are now underway in Florida, New Jersey, and elsewhere in the hope of acquiring definite evidence as to what has caused the apparent sterility of much of the eagle population. Meanwhile, the available circumstantial evidence points to insecticides. In localities where fish are abundant, they make up a large part of the eagle's diet, about 65% in Alaska, about 52% in the Chesapeake Bay area. Almost unquestionably, the eagles so long studied by Mr. Broly were predominantly fish eaters. Since 1945, this particular coastal area has been subjected to repeated sprayings with DDT dissolved in fuel oil. The principal target of the aerial spraying was the salt marsh mosquito, which inhabits the marshes and coastal areas that are typical foraging areas for the eagles. Fishes and crabs were killed in enormous numbers. Laboratory analysis of their tissues revealed high concentrations of DDT, as much as 46 parts per million. Like the grebes of Clear Lake, which accumulated heavy concentrations of insecticide residues from eating the fish of the lake, the eagles have almost certainly been storing up the DDT in the tissues of their bodies. And like the grebes, the pheasants, the quail, and the robins, they are less and less able to produce young and to preserve the continuity of their race. From all over the world come echoes of the peril that faces birds in our modern world. The reports differ in detail, but always repeat the theme of death to wildlife in the wake of pesticides. Such are the stories of hundreds of small birds and partridges dying in France after vine stumps were treated with an arsenic-containing herbicide, or of partridge shoots in Belgium, once famous for the numbers of their birds denuded of partridges after the spraying of nearby farmlands. In England, the major problem seems to be a specialized one, linked with the growing practice of treating seed with insecticides before sowing. Seed treatment is not a wholly new thing, but in earlier years, the chemicals principally used were fungicides. No effects on birds seem to have been noticed. Then about 1956, there was a change to dual-purpose treatment. In addition to a fungicide, dieldrin, aldrin, or heptachlor was added to combat soil insects. Thereupon, the situation changed for the worse. In the spring of 1960, a deluge of reports of dead birds reached British wildlife authorities, including the British Trust for Ornithology, the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds, and the Game Birds Association. "The place is like a battlefield," a landowner in Norfolk wrote. "My keeper has found innumerable corpses, including masses of small birds, chaffinches, greenfinches, linnets, hedge sparrows, and also house sparrows. The destruction of wildlife is quite pitiful." A gamekeeper wrote, "My partridges have been wiped out with the dressed corn, also some pheasants and all other birds. Hundreds of birds have been killed." "As a lifelong gamekeeper, it has been a distressing experience for me. It is bad to see pairs of partridges that have died together." In a joint report, the British Trust of Ornithology and the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds described some 67 kills of birds, a far from complete listing of the destruction that took place in the spring of 1960. Of these 67, 59 were caused by seed dressings, 8 by toxic sprays. A new wave of poisoning set in the following year. The death of 600 birds on a single estate in Norfolk was reported to the House of Lords, and 100 pheasants died on a farm in North Essex. It soon became evident that more counties were involved than in 1960, 34 compared with 23. Lincolnshire, heavily agricultural, seemed to have suffered most, with reports of 10,000 birds dead. But destruction involved all of agricultural England, from Angus in the north to Cornwall in the south, from Anglesey in the west to Norfolk in the east. In the spring of 1961, concern reached such a peak that a special committee of the House of Commons made an investigation of the matter, taking testimony from farmers, landowners, and representatives of the Ministry of Agriculture and of various governmental and non-governmental agencies concerned with wildlife. "Pigeons are suddenly dropping out of the sky dead," said one witness. "You can drive 100 or 200 miles outside London and not see a single kestrel," reported another. "There has been no parallel in the present century, or at any time so far as I am aware. This is the biggest risk to wildlife and game that ever occurred in the country," officials of the Nature Conservancy testified. Facilities for chemical analysis of the victims were most inadequate to the task, with only 2 chemists in the country able to make the tests, one the government chemist, the other in the employ of the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds. Witnesses described huge bonfires on which the bodies of the birds were burned, but efforts were made to have carcasses collected for examination and of the birds analyzed. All but one contained pesticide residues. The single exception was a snipe, which is not a seed-eating bird. Along with the birds, foxes also may have been affected, probably indirectly by eating poisoned mice or birds. England, plagued by rabbits, sorely needs the fox as a predator. But between November 1959 and April 1960, at least 1,300 foxes died. Deaths were heaviest in the same counties from which sparrow, hawks, kestrel, and other birds of prey virtually disappeared, suggesting that the poison was spreading through the food chain, reaching out from the seed-eaters to the furred and feathered carnivores. The actions of the moribund foxes were those of animals poisoned by chlorinated hydrocarbon insecticides. They were seen wandering in circles, dazed and half-blind, before dying in convulsions. The hearings convinced the committee that the threat to wildlife was most alarming. It accordingly recommended to the House of Commons that the Minister of Agriculture and the Secretary of State for Scotland should secure the immediate prohibition for the use as seed dressings of compounds containing dieldrin, aldrin, or heptachlor, or chemicals of comparable toxicity. The committee also recommended more adequate controls to ensure that chemicals were adequately tested under field as well as laboratory conditions before being put on the market. This, it is worth emphasizing, is one of the great blank spots in pesticide research everywhere. Manufacturers' tests on the common laboratory animals, rats, dogs, guinea pigs, include no wild species, no birds as a rule, no fishes, and are conducted under controlled and artificial conditions. Their application to wildlife in the field is anything but precise. England is by no means alone in its problem of protecting birds from treated seeds. Here in the United States, the problem has been most troublesome in the rice-growing areas of California in the South. For a number of years, California rice growers have been treating seed with DDT as protection against tadpole shrimp and scavenger beetles, which sometimes damage seedling rice. California sportsmen have enjoyed excellent hunting because of the concentrations of waterfowl and pheasants in the rice fields. But for the past decade, persistent reports of bird losses, especially among pheasants, ducks, and blackbirds, have come from the rice-growing counties. Pheasant sickness became a well-known phenomenon. Birds seek water, become paralyzed, and are found on the ditch banks and rice checks, quivering, according to one observer. The sickness comes in the spring, at the time the rice fields are seeded. The concentration of DDT used is many times the amount that will kill an adult pheasant. The passage of a few years and the development of even more poisonous insecticides served to increase the hazard from treated seed. Aldrin, which is 100 times as toxic as DDT to pheasants, is now widely used as a seed coating. In the rice fields of eastern Texas, the practice has seriously reduced populations of the fulvous tree duck, a tawny-colored goose-like duck of the Gulf Coast. Indeed, there is some reason to think that the rice growers, having found a way to reduce the populations of blackbirds, are using the insecticide for a dual purpose, with disastrous effects on several bird species of the rice fields. As the habit of killing grows, the resort to eradicating any creature that may annoy or inconvenience us, birds are more and more finding themselves a direct target of poisons rather than an incidental one. There is a growing trend toward aerial applications of such deadly poisons as parathion to control concentrations of birds distasteful to farmers. The Fish and Wildlife Service has found it necessary to express serious concern over this trend, pointing out that parathion-treated areas constitute a potential hazard to humans, domestic animals, and wildlife. In southern Indiana, for example, a group of farmers went together in the summer of 1959 to engage a spray plane to treat an area of river bottomland with parathion. The area was a favorite roosting site for thousands of blackbirds that were feeding in nearby cornfields. The problem could have been solved easily by a slight change in agricultural practice, a shift to a variety of corn with deep-set ears not accessible to the birds. The results probably gratified the farmers, for the casualty list included some 65,000 red-winged blackbirds and starlings. What other wildlife deaths may have gone unnoticed and unrecorded is not known. Parathion is not a specific for blackbirds. It is a universal killer. But such rabbits or raccoons or opossums as may have roamed those bottomlands and perhaps never visited the farmers' cornfields were doomed by a judge and jury who neither knew of their existence nor cared. And what of human beings? In California orchards, sprayed with the same parathion, workers handling foliage that had been treated a month earlier collapsed and went into shock and escaped death only through skilled medical attention. Does Indiana still raise any boys who roam through woods or fields and might even explore the margins of a river? If so, who guarded the poisoned areas to keep out any who might wander in misguided search for unspoiled nature? Who kept vigilant watch to tell the innocent stroller that the fields he was about to enter were deadly, all their vegetation coated with lethal film? Yet at so fearful a risk, the farmers, with none to hinder them, waged their needless war on blackbirds. In each of these situations, one turns away to ponder the question, who has made the decision that sets in motion these chains of poisonings, this ever-widening wave of death that spreads out like ripples when a pebble is dropped in a still pond? Who has placed in one pan of the scales the leaves that might have been eaten by the beetles, and in the other the pitiful heaps of many-hued feathers, the lifeless remains of the birds that fell before the unselective bludgeon of insecticidal poisons? Who has decided? Who has the right to decide for the countless legions of people who were not consulted that the supreme value is a world without insects, even though it be also a sterile world, ungraced by the curving wing of a bird in flight? The decision is that of the authoritarian temporarily entrusted with power. He has made it during a moment of inattention by millions to whom beauty and the ordered world of nature still have a meaning that is deep and imperative. Chapter 9, Rivers of Death. From the green depths of the offshore Atlantic, many paths lead back to the coast. They are paths followed by fish. Although unseen and intangible, they are linked with the outflow of waters from the coastal rivers. For thousands upon thousands of years, the salmon have known and followed these threads of fresh water that lead them back to the rivers, each returning to the tributary in which it spent the first months or years of life. So in the summer and fall of 1953, the salmon of the river called Miramichi on the coast of New Brunswick moved in from their feeding grounds in the far Atlantic and ascended their native river. In the upper reaches of the Miramichi, in streams that gather together a network of shadowed brooks, the salmon deposited their eggs that autumn in beds of gravel over which the stream water flowed swift and cold. Such places, the watersheds of the great coniferous forests of spruce and balsam, of hemlock and pine, provide the kind of spawning grounds that salmon must have in order to survive. These events repeated a pattern that was age-old, a pattern that had made the Miramichi one of the finest salmon streams in North America. But that year the pattern was to be broken. During the fall and winter, the salmon eggs, large and thick-shelled, lay in shallow gravel-filled troughs, or reds, which the mother fish had dug in the stream bottom. In the cold of winter, they developed slowly, as was their way, and only when spring at last brought thawing and release to the forest streams did the young hatch. At first they hid among the pebbles of the stream bed, tiny fish, about half an inch long. They took no food, living on the large yolk sac. Not until it was absorbed would they begin to search the stream for small insects. With the newly hatched salmon in the Miramichi that spring of 1954 were young of previous hatchings, salmon a year or two old, young fish in brilliant coats marked with bars and bright red spots. These young fed voraciously, seeking out the strange and varied insect life of the stream. As the summer approached, all this was changed. That year, the watershed of the Northwest Miramichi was included in a vast spraying program which the Canadian government had embarked upon the previous year, a program designed to save the forests from the spruce budworm. The budworm is a native insect that attacks several kinds of evergreens. In eastern Canada, it seems to become extraordinarily abundant about every 35 years. The early 1950s had seen such an upsurge in the budworm populations. To combat it, spraying with DDT was begun, first in a small way, then at a suddenly accelerated rate in 1953. Millions of acres of forests were sprayed instead of thousands as before, in an effort to save the balsams, which are the mainstay of the pulp and paper industry. So in 1954, in the month of June, the plains visited the forests of the Northwest Miramichi, and white clouds of settling mist marked the crisscross pattern of their flight. The spray, 1/2 pound of DDT to the acre in a solution of oil, filtered down through the balsam forests, and some of it finally reached the ground and the flowing streams. The pilots, their thoughts only on their assigned task, made no effort to avoid the streams or to shut off the spray nozzles while flying over them. But because spray drifts so far in even the slightest stirring of air, perhaps the result would have been little different if they had. Soon after the spraying had ended, there were unmistakable signs that all was not well. Within 2 days, dead and dying fish, including many young salmon, were found along the banks of the stream. Brook trout also appeared among the dead fish, and along the roads and in the woods, birds were dying. All the life of the stream was stilled. Before the spraying, there had been a rich assortment of the water life that forms the food of salmon and trout. Caddisfly larvae living in loosely fitting protective cases of leaves, stems, or gravel cemented together with saliva. Stonefly nymphs clinging to rocks in the swirling currents. And the worm-like larvae of blackflies edging the stones under riffles or where the stream spills over steeply slanting rocks. But now the stream insects were dead, killed by the DDT, and there was nothing for a young salmon to eat. Amid such a picture of death and destruction, the young salmon themselves could hardly have been expected to escape, and they didn't. By August, not one of the young salmon that had emerged from the gravel beds that spring remained. A whole year's spawning had come to nothing. The older young, those hatched a year or more earlier, fared only slightly better. For every 6 young of the 1953 hatch that had foraged in the stream as the plains approached, only one remained. Young salmon of the 1952 hatch, almost ready to go to sea, lost a third of their numbers. All these facts are known because the Fisheries Research Board of Canada had been conducting a salmon study on the Northwest Miramichi since 1950. Each year, it had made a census of the fish living in this stream. The records of biologists covered the number of adult salmon ascending to spawn, the number of young of each age group present in the stream, and the normal population not only of salmon, but of other species of fish inhabiting the stream. With this complete record of pre-spraying conditions, it was possible to measure the damage done by the spraying with an accuracy that has seldom been matched elsewhere. The survey showed more than the loss of young fish. It revealed a serious change in the streams themselves. Repeated sprayings have now completely altered the stream environment, and the aquatic insects that are the food of salmon and trout have been killed. A great deal of time is required, even after a single spraying, for most of these insects to build up sufficient numbers to support a normal salmon population. Time measured in years rather than months. The smaller species, such as midges and black flies, become re-established rather quickly. These are suitable food for the smallest salmon, the fry, only a few months old. But there is no such rapid recovery of the larger aquatic insects on which salmon in their second and third years depend. These are the larval stages of caddisflies, stoneflies, and mayflies. Even in the second year after DDT enters a stream, a foraging salmon par would have trouble finding anything more than an occasional small stonefly. There would be no large stoneflies, no mayflies, no caddisflies. In an effort to supply this natural food, the Canadians have attempted to transplant caddisfly larvae and other insects to the barren reaches of the Miramichi. But of course, such transplants would be wiped out by any repeated spraying. The budworm populations, instead of dwindling as expected, had proved refractory, and from 1955 to 1957, spraying was repeated in various parts of New Brunswick and Quebec, some places being sprayed as many as 3 times. By 1957, nearly 15 million acres had been sprayed. Although spraying was then tentatively suspended, a sudden resurgence of budworms led to its resumption in 1960 and 1961. Indeed, there is no evidence anywhere that chemical spraying for budworm control is more than a stopgap measure aimed at saving the trees from death through defoliation over several successive years. And so its unfortunate side effects will continue to be felt as spraying is continued. In an effort to minimize the destruction of fish, on the recommendation of the Fisheries Research Board, the Canadian forestry officials have reduced the concentration of DDT from the 0.5 pound previously used to 0.25 pound to the acre. In the United States, the standard and highly lethal pound to the acre still prevails. Now, after several years in which to observe the effects of spraying, the Canadians find a mixed situation, but one that affords very little comfort to devotees of salmon fishing, provided spraying is continued. A very unusual combination of circumstances has so far saved the runs of the Northwest Miramichi from the destruction that was anticipated. A constellation of happenings that might not occur again in a century. It is important to understand what has happened there and the reasons for it. In 1954, as we have seen, the watershed of this branch of the Miramichi was heavily sprayed. Thereafter, except for a narrow band sprayed in 1956, the whole upper watershed of this branch was excluded from the spraying program. In the fall of 1954, a tropical storm played its part in the fortunes of the Miramichi salmon. Hurricane Edna, a violent storm to the very end of its northward path, brought torrential rains to the New England and Canadian coasts. The resulting freshets carried streams of fresh water far out to sea and drew in unusual numbers of salmon. As a result, the gravel beds of the streams which the salmon seek out for spawning received an unusual abundance of eggs. The young salmon hatching in the Northwest Miramichi in the spring of 1955 found circumstances practically ideal for their survival. While the DDT had killed off all stream insects the year before, the smallest of the insects, the midges and the black flies, had returned in numbers. These are the normal food of baby salmon. The salmon fry of that year not only found abundant food, but they had few competitors for it. This was because of the grim fact that the older young salmon had been killed off by the spraying in 1954. Accordingly, the fry of 1955 grew very fast and survived in exceptional numbers. They completed their stream growth rapidly and went to sea early. Many of them returned in 1959 to give large runs of grilse to the native stream. If the runs in the Northwest Miramichi are still in relatively good condition, this is because spraying was done in 1 year only. The results of repeated spraying are clearly seen in other streams of the watershed where alarming declines in the salmon populations are occurring. In all sprayed streams, young salmon of every size are scarce. The youngest are often practically wiped out, the biologists report. In the main Southwest Miramichi, which was sprayed in 1956 and 1957, the 1959 catch was the lowest in a decade. Fishermen remarked on the extreme scarcity of grilse, the youngest group of returning fish. At the sampling trap in the estuary of the Miramichi, the count of grilse was only a fourth as large in 1959 as the year before. In 1959, the whole Miramichi watershed produced only about 600,000 smolt, young salmon descending to the sea. This was less than a third of the runs of the three preceding years. Against such a background, the future of salmon fisheries in New Brunswick may well depend on finding a substitute for drenching forests with DDT.
This ends Disc 4.